Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 525th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Gall. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice sport at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at U of A.
Very nice. And you look like you've lost some weight. Although I can't see you at all. I have no idea.
Well, thank you. Thank you, James, for that. It's neither sincere or realistic.
No. And I'm following your lead.
Thank you. But let's move on, because we've been talking about weight, and it turns out that being a little bit overweight is not nearly so bad.
Yeah.
But being really quite overweight is not a good thing.
Yeah. And you're right. And so that was the first
overweight episode. I mean obese.
Yeah. And in the last podcast, we talked about, and I think importantly, we talked about some of the words that we should use to describe maybe link it to health, not to what you physically look like. And I think that was useful. And I think, you know, we also went over the association between BMI and bad outcomes. And there are some good outcomes, like in men, less depression, overall less fractures and that sort of stuff. And so we went over all that evidence. And I think the bottom line, we said, well, one of the most important things is, you know, if you're at least being physically active, that is a key thing when it comes to weight and
or to health.
To health. But now, as you know, Mike, if one thing is not clearly associated with bad outcome, we measure many other things.
Mm-hmm. And if we can find a justification to find some special pleading argument that this answer doesn't work for every single person, well, we need another answer. Not that it will work for every single person, but it gives us more to talk about.
Yeah, and we've seen where we try to refine our estimates by, in cardiovascular disease, you know, high sensitivity C-reactive protein, you know, lipoprotein A, all those different things that we can measure. And we're not going to talk about those today, but we are going to talk about ones that are associated with, can we better predict outcomes by looking at people, for one thing, and doing other measurements? And there's a variety of different ones that are done. You know, you've probably heard the adage, it's not whether you're heavy or not, it's where you carry that weight. I'm sure you've heard that, Mike.
Absolutely. It's the same. But that does, when I say I've absolutely heard it, that doesn't mean we're going to talk about different ways of assessing where you're carrying the weight and if it's more important than whether what your weight is to your height,
BMI. Yeah. And so there's waist circumference that you can do. And then something that always made me sort of laugh in a sad sort of way, they've described, you know, different fruit shapes of people. And I'm sure some of you are quite familiar with the apple shape and the pear shape, but I was unaware there's also a strawberry shape, a banana shape, and an hourglass shape, and all that sort of stuff. And all of that relates to things where there's also a thing called a waist to hip ratio. So there's all sorts of other ways to assess weight. And the issue is that of any value to anybody? And the way you try to figure that out, as you know, Mike, is you look at a whole bunch of cohorts and see if looking at not just BMI, but also BMI plus waist circumference or BMI plus waist to hip ratios or BMI plus anything, and does it change the actual prediction model? And
even instead of plus, just versus.
Versus,
so
yeah.
Can I use waist circumference instead of BMI?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Determine. Yeah.
And the reason I was saying in addition to, because I doubt we're going to go away from at least measuring weight. So, you know, does it make a difference? But there's been a number of people that have looked at it. There's been some systematic reviews that have looked at this one from The Lancet in 2011 where they said your BMI is just as good as waist measurement for making predictions, which in other words, it means it's as good as just using your weight from that perspective. And then there was one done a couple of years ago in the BMJ where they looked at, you know, thigh circumference and body adiposity index, body shape index, waist to height ratio, waist to hip ratio, waist to thigh ratio for their ability to predict mortality. And all of those measurements were, interestingly, were associated with all-cause mortality, but, and they concluded in a very wishy-washy. They said measurements of fat at the waist could be used in conjunction with BMI to determine the risk of premature death. But when you actually look at the results, it didn't make much difference at all. So it's that, well, you could do it if you wanted to. And then there was another one just recently in a journal called Previous Chronic Disease, where they looked at 40 cohorts, and they actually did, you know, all the, and again, I don't want to get into all of this, but they did these things called AUC ROC values. And it's just a way of looking at the association between something and getting something else. And yeah, that was a very good description
of it. That was really vague. It's for those who actually know, it's an area under the curve. Yeah. It's the, or it's called the thing that's generated when you do those analysis is called the C statistic. And the ROC is receiver operator curve, which is basically the same thing. And it's just saying, how well does BMI predict, and you can pick anything, heart attack, death, whatever. And in this case, they were, how well does it predict heart attack, stroke, and diabetes, and other things. And it's just a way to assess how well these things predict one another.
And that's why you don't need to know what AUC and ROC stand for.
Yeah.
It's just an ability to predict things. And they were able to show that you could predict them just a little bit better in some cases. But the differences were so small, and in fact, many of them were not statistically significant when you were looking at BMI or waist circumference or waist to hip ratio, that it really didn't make any sort of a difference whether you were using more than just something like BMI. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know in your, when you were practicing, Mike, did you do sort of waist circumferences and all that sort of stuff? Or
I never did that. Yes. I think maybe when a resident was asking me and very keen on this, I might've done it once, but I've heard these, you know, support for different things like this. And the studies you quoted are different than some of the ones that I found, which, you know, and I can recall some showing that one is slightly better than the other, and sometimes it's BMI that's on top.
Yeah.
And so I really lost, and it was always, you know, that kind of, you know, one's at 70 and the other one's, so that's the area under the curve. Yeah. It's 0.7 would be the other way to say it. It's at 0.7 and the other one's at 0.72.
Yeah.
And then we're supposed to go, oh, wow. So the other one is better.
Yeah.
No, those confidence intervals completely overlap. And the next time you do the analysis, it shows the opposite. One is, the first one is 0.72 and the other one is 0.70. And it's just, to me, I think we're wasting our time looking at questions like this when we should be looking at solutions for.
So are you saying we're wasting our time measuring the waist?
We're wasting our time measuring the waist.
Yes.
Yeah. You're looking for that pun, right?
It doesn't get any better than that.
Oh, wow. Well, you already said that we provided something useful in the last podcast, which is, if I'm not mistaken, where are we at now? 500?
Yeah. Yeah. And we don't, but you probably noticed I haven't said anything about low dose in the last two podcasts, and I'm not about to. So let's keep going. So how do we assess these things? Well, you know, you can weigh people, and that's, you know, most of us would have weigh scales. Certainly you do have them in the healthcare environment and all that sort of stuff. And I thought it might be useful to just talk about measurement error, because measurement error is an important issue. And we'll talk about this when we talk about how much weight do you lose on a diet and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, a weight scale, the typical error is about a 0.5%. So anywhere between 1 and 2 pounds, or, you know, maybe a half to a kilo. And so that's pretty decent. You can, you know, check to see whether or not you've lost weight. Now, when it comes to waist circumference, though, the error is 10 times greater than that. It's about 5%. So it's about, depending on what your waist circumference was, that's about 2 inches or 5 centimeters in that sort of error of measurement. And you can imagine, you know, where one, just using the thing, how tight do you pull it? Is the person breathing in or out? Are they trying to make it look like their waist circumference is less or more, and all those sorts of things? And so with the error, let's go back to the thing, you know, when you look at most diets, you know, Mike, I'm sure you remember the number. What's the sort of number that you'd lose on a diet? It's not massive.
No, it's about 1 to 2 kilograms at most.
Yeah.
At most.
Yeah.
On most diets, if you follow people long enough.
Yeah. So if you're talking about that, and let's even assume you went on a diet and you could lose, I don't know, 8 pounds or just under 4 kilograms. You literally are not going to be able to pick that up by measuring waist circumference because of the error associated with it. And so if you truly want to see, are you actually starting to lose weight, really the best and probably the only way that you need to do it is using a weigh scale. The other measurements might be interesting, but you're going to miss that you're having even a small change. And it would be a shame if you didn't use the weigh scale and only use something like waist circumference. But I'd suggest you don't have to do anything but a weigh scale, and that will tell you where you're going with from your weight perspective.
That sounds too
simple.
Trying to help people with their weight, and you're saying that to do that you need to weigh them.
Yeah, yeah. And
I hope you're taking notes at home.
Yeah, people. I know. Exactly. Now, there's actually also a big debate about, you know, how often should you weigh yourself? And you know what? There's no great answer. It depends on, I've seen some people feel better weighing themselves every day. And really, if you're looking at, are you going to be able to pick up a change? You're not going to lose more than 1 or 2 pounds over a period of a week. So maybe once a week is all you need to see if you're actually changing weight. But there is no right answer. I looked to see if there was, you know, is it better to go, you know, once a day or 2 or 3 times a week or once a week? And it's somewhere probably in between is the right amount to do it. But you're only going to be able to pick up, you know, changes in weight of around 2 pounds as you're trying to lose weight. So that's the issue with the measurement error. And I think, Mike, I think you are not measuring all of those things, not because you really knew the evidence. You're just being lazy. No, I'm just kidding. But you are actually right. It's so much in medicine, so much in our podcast. It's just do less measurement.
Yeah, and it's people who are passionate about a specific area there's some trick out there. There must be that we can puzzle out these medical issues better. Mm-hmm. And I think we get wrapped up in these ideas where it's often better just to keep things simple. And like I was being very bold about, if the issue is weight, let's talk about what someone weighs. And then that's how you follow that. And I remember seeing that in an RCT of different diet types. And this is the one where people were sequestered, where they mm-hmm. were put in basically a hospital ward. The more negative people can think of it, like a prison, for I think it was 2 weeks. And they found the weight in one of the diets, and I can't even remember which one, dropped most quickly in the first few days.
Yeah.
And they associated up to a 2 pound weight loss to intestinal contents.
Yes. Yeah.
Intestinal contents. So you can imagine what that means if you abbreviate that, but it's telling us that like a 2 pound weight loss can be accomplished with that. So if you're measuring every day, there's a lot of variability, your water weight, all sorts of things, and intestinal contents, etc. So are you picking up the amount of actual difference in adipose tissue in one day? Obviously not. So it's just keeping that in mind. But it might be, there's always someone to argue each side of it. So the alternative to that is maybe that is what continues to motivate you.
Yeah.
By measuring more regularly.
So yeah. Yeah. It's very individualized, for sure. So that those are the issues that we've talked about with BMI and the association with outcomes and all that sort of stuff. And then one question that you, when we were putting this together, you sort of said, well, what about, does it actually improve outcomes when we intentionally try to lose weight? Because I know you originally had come to me and said, well, you know, I've seen some evidence that says maybe it doesn't.
Right. So this comes from, you know, when I was asked to do a lifestyle talk 15 years ago, mm-hmm. plus, probably even more than that. And I was looking at the evidence and I had taken it for, you know, truth that yeah. a weight loss was a good thing. Once you got big, and there's no doubt that it's kind of like diabetes and so many things that once you get worse sugar control, or as you're getting worse sugar control, or as you're getting bigger, it's associated with a lot of negative health outcomes. Mm. But does the losing the weight, does reversing that process make a difference? And does it even matter how you reverse that mm-hmm. process? So that was what I had seen stuff that, no, it didn't actually. And the reason, but before we get into the data that James is going to take from his recent search, one of the tricks here is that these are, again, observational cohort studies. So people who are losing weight, a lot of the times those cohorts included patients who were losing weight for reasons like cancer and things like mm-hmm. that. They weren't intentionally losing weight. And back when I was looking at the literature 15, 20 years ago, that was hard to tease out from right. the observational studies. Yeah, yeah. There were people in there who were losing weight, but it wasn't clear that it was intentional. And that raises questions of just how sick they might be.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that, when you were doing that was from a 2009 publication where they actually showed, interestingly, in healthy people, there was a statistically significant increase association with all-cause mortality with intentional weight loss.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, so that was, I think, the last one I found. That was probably the most recent. It's only 13 years ago or so. So
yeah, and there's been, yeah. and to be honest with you, there hasn't been a ton more on that. There's been a systematic review that's looked at people who are obese or have type 2 diabetes, and also people with coronary artery disease. And interestingly, none of those cohorts showed a statistically significant difference. Now, the point estimates were in the direction of, at least not in the direction of harm, which is good.
Yes.
You know, and also since that time, there have been some RCTs. And you can imagine, this is a difficult RCT, because how do you randomize people to lose weight or not lose weight? You can't go, well, you can. You could say you don't lose weight, but you do whatever you were doing. And all of them that have been done where they've looked at different ways of losing weight, they've all shown point estimates in the direction of a benefit. Now, not only one of them was really statistically significantly different, and that was looking at low-fat diets. And here's where it's difficult, Mike. How do you tease out, is it the weight loss, or is it because you're doing a different diet?
Well, it gets even more complicated yes. when you look at the literature. If you were to say to a patient, James, what diet is the most healthy heart diet that you can do, it wouldn't be low fat.
No.
You'd have to say Mediterranean. All the studies that I'm aware of that are of the Mediterranean diet, and there are, I think, four now that are large enough, maybe it's five, I can't quite remember. But there's a handful, all of them that I can think of, compared the Mediterranean diet to the low fat, and they found reductions in cardiovascular disease and in cases where risk was higher, mortality.
Yeah.
So if low-fat diet is working in these RCTs, but Mediterranean diet is better than that, and Mediterranean diet, by the way, in those studies, you didn't lose any weight.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is an interesting thing. And then what about if we did it as a kind of the diets that result in the greatest weight loss, which are starvation diets? So kind of the weight loss and they're eating kind of an 800 calorie diet for extended periods. Usually they allow gradual addition back of calories, but you're still on quite a reduced diet even then. So what would those find? I wonder, but I don't think we have answers.
No, it's very tricky. And you know, we're talking about endpoints like cardiovascular disease and mortality and so on. We are not talking about, do you get changes in, and I don't even like this term, metabolic things? Like,
oh,
yeah. I know that hurts, Mike.
It does hurt me. I was hoping you were going to go with quality of life.
Oh, yeah. Well, we can get to quality. Yeah, we'll get to quality.
I might have even said good work, James, something like that.
Well,
like
we'll get there because I need that for my quality of life.
a very significant, you need that.
That affirmation.
Well,
yeah.
Again, it's nearing the end of the year, so I have to throw one your way.
Yeah, yeah. But it's so there are trials that show that, you know, glucose will get a bit better. There are trials that show that blood pressure will get a bit better. There are trials that show that, you know, actually it's not great stuff with cholesterol and all that, but there are trials that show those changes. But often those changes are so small you couldn't pick it up in an individual patient anyway, given the variation in any sort of lab tests. But those are the endpoints that we're not talking about because of all the stuff that we've been talking about for the last 524 podcasts.
Yeah, but there is one study that should be mentioned. It was a study, again, of starvation diet for diabetics, and it found that a large number could be pushed into remission. And I think it was, if they lost more than 15 kilograms, 85% or 80% or something like that went into remission. And the subgroup, I think after 2 years, it was 40 versus 5 or something. But I think there's a 25% difference. I'm not quite remembering, but absolute difference. But regardless, you can actually push sugars down enough. So James was saying, he's absolutely right. The changes are often tiny, but when you really lose weight, you can actually put diabetes in remission.
Yeah. And I'm still considering, you know, diabetes as a sort of a surrogate marker versus...
It's just a cut point.
Yeah,
it's
just a cut point. Yeah. Yeah. And we'll get to this at some point when we get to the podcast where we compare low carb versus low fat diets and the incidence of, and I'm, if you could see me, what I'm doing air quotes around remission, the word remission, because...
Well, I got in trouble for saying it was cured. I got in a lot of trouble for saying that. So that's why I'm using the word remission.
Ah.
Yeah. So just FYI.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad I wasn't there when you got in trouble. So that's, you know, that's the evidence that, you know, around more all-cause mortality. And interestingly enough, there's not even much stuff around when you look for cardiovascular disease. There is a single cohort that has looked at it, and it did show a statistically significant a lowering or an association with a lower risk of coronary artery disease. But there's not a lot of information. There was a meta-analysis, but it was only one RCT. So we actually don't have great data on intentional weight loss. And that's not for a second to suggest that, you know, if you were to take a person who is 400 pounds and they lose 200 pounds, that's a different story. But that's not the vast majority of most people's practice, or it's not the vast majority of most people in the world.
We all have stories who've been in practice of the patient who absolutely embraced a lifestyle change, lost a ton of weight, became active, all of those. We all have those very motivational stories, but
we're not poo-pooing those at all.
Yeah, because it is awesome. So just as I did just find that study. It was quality of life improved 6 to 10 out of 100. For those of you who know what that means, that's huge. Those who got a weight loss of greater than 15 kilograms, 86% went into remission. The average remission was 4% in those eating a regular diet and 46% of those. That reduced to a 25% difference. That, as you can see, is over 40% difference. So a number needed to treat of 3. And in the next year, some people gained weight again, and the difference was only 25% with a number needed to treat of 4. But it is, there are studies that do show with very significant weight reduction, you can change metabolic parameters quite considerably. And that's really what we're talking about with diabetes. It's a surrogate marker, as James is indicating. And you've shifted it below a cut point. These people were off medicines, by the way, by that. Yeah. So they were below cut point and off medicine. So impressive.
Yeah, no, for sure. And then probably what's one of the more important things is there have been some similar cohort studies that have looked at what about increasing physical activity and mortality? Because, you know, because you increase physical activity doesn't mean you're going to lose weight by any stretch of the imagination. But but all of the cohort studies, they weren't all statistically significantly different, but almost all of them are showing that if you increase physical activity, you lower your risk of mortality. And, you know, of all-cause mortality and cardiovascular mortality and so on. So It's tricky because these things are all tied together. Weight loss, you know, diet and activity. It's hard to tease out any one specifically. But I think when you look at most of it, physical activity really shines above the other two.
Yeah, above weight loss and stuff. Yeah,
yeah. And then finally, and this
as far as changing your risk of having an outcome like death or cardiovascular disease.
No, really, exactly. Yeah. And then now some of the stuff where you see, you know, some, you know, I think it'd be very hard to argue the benefit of it is with bariatric surgery and mortality. You know, there have been no randomized controlled trials again of that, but there's been a systematic meta-analysis, systematic review and meta-analysis of 39 cohort studies where they followed people for anywhere from 2 to 24 years. And these are people mainly with BMIs 40 plus. So, that's where you would typically be talking about bariatric surgery. And the results were really quite consistent, is that mortality was reduced relatively by 45%. Also heart failure, MI and stroke were reduced anywhere from 40 to 50%. And those are all relative numbers. And it's a very consistent finding from cohort studies. So if you're wondering what is the evidence for the bariatric surgery, that's the best evidence that I could find is from 39 cohort studies. And in this population, you know, their mortality was in the 5 to 10% range. So if you could cut half of that out, that's pretty good.
Yeah, so if your chance of mortality is around 10% and you cut it in half, that's a number needed to treat of 20. So
yeah.
But for a number needed to treat of 20, the other things are like treatments for heart failure, because those people have such high mortality. So it's not common to see that level of benefit, but that's because the risk is so high.
Yeah, no, exactly. And then, so that was bariatric surgery. Now, you know, we were talking a little bit about, you know, health related quality of life, which is clearly an issue. And I think, you know, there was a systematic review of reviews done about 4 or 5 years ago, where they looked at the relationship between obesity and weight loss and health-related quality of life. And they found that, you know, especially if your BMI was greater than 40, you could definitely see an improvement in health-related quality of life. But interestingly, you know, when they looked at all of the randomized controlled trial data, all of the evidence that they could find, their conclusion was that one might expect consistent associations between weight loss and improved health-related quality of life, but the studies are not conclusive. And, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with, are we talking about losing 150 pounds or are we talking about losing 5 pounds?
Right. And so if you look at things like interventions with the greatest effect on weight loss, so the one that I just mentioned earlier, it had the average patient was losing a lot more weight in it. And in those studies, the health related quality of life was 6 to 10 improvement, which is quite dramatic. In the studies of semaglutide, where 15 kilograms is not uncommon, the health related quality of life changes there approach 10 as well. So,
and that's 10 on a scale of
100. So yeah. All of the quality of life for most people, just, if they care who are listening, it's a 0 to 1 scale. And it's, and then when you're getting down near the bottom, that's where quality of life is the absolute lowest. And when it's that low, it's really, you know, life is very miserable. And then many conditions like, angina, stroke, et cetera, they put you somewhere around a 0.6 or 0.7. And then, if you severe COPD, same kind of thing, down to, if it's very severe, it's down to kind of 0.6, 0.5. But, and many of the puffers we give you maybe a couple points on there on average. But these kind of lifestyle interventions, when followed through, result in, like, when they get a bigger result, like the ones we've listed or I've listed, the effects are relatively large. Bigger than most drugs we give, that's for sure.
Yeah, I know you use the word dramatic. I think, you know, a 10-point change on a 100-point scale is, I mean, it's it's valuable. I don't know. Dramatic would not be a word.
You have to remember where you start.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, if you started at 30.
If you're starting at 0.3, if you're starting at 0.7 and you get to 0.8, that's a big change.
Yeah,
that's two-thirds or a third improvement in your quality of life. Exactly. So
that's
pretty good.
Yeah, no, for sure. And then there's also been a group that looked at a systematic review with meta-analysis of the impact of weight loss for reducing pain and disability in people with common musculoskeletal disorders. Because if you remember the previous evidence we talked about, Mike, it showed that, you know, as you get heavier, you just get more hip and knee and back pain. And they were able to show that with weight losses of 5 to 6 kilograms over a period of anywhere from 6 weeks to 3 years, they were able to show a reduction in two things. One was pain, OA pain, and then disability. And the changes in those scales were roughly around a 1-point change in a 10-point scale or a 4-point change in a 68-point scale. So around a 10% relative change in those pain scores. And that's the sort of number where we say that's likely at least the minimally important clinical difference.
Yeah, it's probably approaching that.
Yeah. But then the tricky part is these are weight loss, but was it the weight loss or was it the exercise that did it? You know, so
you won't know.
It's really hard to tease all of that out. So anyway, so that's a lot of the stuff that we wanted to talk about when it comes to weight and the benefit of losing weight and so on. And I think we can conclude with a few things. I think if for no other reason than I think it's nicer, we should stop categorizing people using BMI with the terms like overweight. You know, we could just link it to their, you know, we think your weight might be a health issue. I think that's an important way to think about it. So we really need to change the language that we use when weight is discussed. We mentioned a little bit about the association with BMI and outcomes, and maybe overweight is not that big of a deal. We mentioned waist and hip ratio measurements and what sort of fruit you are. It doesn't really seem to inform you much about risk. And probably much of the evidence for the benefit of weight loss is to do with more like activity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the best quotes I ever found was from a guy named Yanni Friedhoff, who was an associate professor in the faculty in family medicine at the University of Ottawa. A good Canadian.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And I really like this line. I wish I would have said it. Is the best weight is whatever weight a person reaches when they're living the healthiest life they can actually enjoy, and they don't have any BMI, weight, or waist circumference goals. And that makes sense. We want you to eat as healthy as you can, be as physically active as you can, and whatever weight that leads you to, that it may be your best weight.
My cat is striving to be morbidly obese, and that would be his dream weight.
Yes. And I have a cat that's in exactly the same, but they don't do anything. But I'm not going to get into a discussion of the pros and cons of cats, because that's a no-win situation, as you probably know, Mike.
It sure is, except CAT scans, James. We can talk about those.
Oh, yeah, that's very, very clever. And I'm assuming you don't have a dog in that fight.
No, nicely done.
Yeah. But anyway, anything else you want to talk about, Mike?
No, that is all good.
Yeah. So the only thing that I would like to discuss with you guys to let you know is we have our annual course coming up in May next year in Vancouver. And we would really, really, really love it if you could attend. It's going to be May 12 and May 13 in absolutely lovely Vancouver. So go to our site, hectalks.com, and check that out. We're just putting together the planning committee and the topics and all that sort of stuff. So we'll keep you informed as we go forward. And I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.